This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Her name is Dolly, 7 months old. She may not be the monster imagined in a science fiction fantasy, yet the cuddly Finn Dorset lamb may represent a major landmark in the history of genetic engineering.
July 1996. Dolly the Finn Dorset did indeed represent a major landmark in the history of genetic engineering. She was the first mammal successfully cloned from an adult somatic cell. Since then, advances in genetic sciences have rapidly accelerated. In 2010, scientists sequenced the entire Neanderthal genome. In 2016, the first human baby with the DNA of three parents was born. In 2020, two scientists won the Nobel Prize for developing CRISPR, a technology that makes gene editing more precise and easier than ever. And in September, Dr. Ariona Hysoli and her colleagues at a new company called Colossal announced they are embarking on a project to bring the woolly mammoth back from extinction.
Many scientists right now would agree that we have the tools to make one calf.
That is, they have the tools to make an elephant calf whose DNA has been edited to add genes for woolly mammoth traits, such as smaller ears, fur, hair, a high-domed skull.
All the science is there. It's solved. I think our mission at Colossal is also to scale this process up. So we want to see hundreds, potentially thousands, of woolly mammoths roaming Siberia.
So, genetic science and our understanding of what genes do seem to be on the precipice of the miraculous, or madness, depending on your point of view. But it is advancing. And yet, researcher Catherine Page Harden says, in all that time, one thing has stubbornly not changed. Quote, how people make sense of the relationship between genetic differences and social inequalities has barely budged in 150 years. Harden is a behavior geneticist and a professor of psychology at the University of Texas, Austin. She's out with a new book. It's called The Genetic Lottery: Why DNA Matters for Social Equality. And she joins us now. Catherine Page Harden, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So I just want to read a small excerpt from the beginning of the book where you write, genetic differences between any two people are tiny when compared to the long stretches of DNA coiled in every human cell. But these differences loom large when trying to understand why, for example, one child has autism and another doesn't, why one is deaf and another is hearing, and why one child will struggle with school and another will not. So you make this point that genetic differences between us matter for our lives. They cause the differences in things we care about, and building a commitment to egalitarianism on our genetic uniformity is building a house on sand. So that's from your new book here. Let's start with this. How much do genetic differences matter when it comes to understanding social differences?
Well, the question of how much it matters always depends on what exactly you're looking at. In my work, I focus a lot on how children do in school and the basic cognitive abilities and personality traits that shape how they move through the educational system. And what we find pretty consistently across a number of different methods is that genetic differences between children are as important as environmental differences between them. So it's not ever just genes or just environment. Always both of these things are contributing to the differences we see in how children are faring in school, or their likelihood of struggling with sort of mental or behavioral health problems such as depression or delinquency.
Okay, so that's why you say to ignore that is building a house on sand. But what exactly are you looking at when you do this research? More specifically, let me ask, there's this new phrase now that I've been introduced to recently called a polygenic score. What is that?
Yeah, so a polygenic score comes from this new ability to measure the genomes of people directly. As you said in your intro, our genetic technology has improved by leaps and bounds. So now in my lab, for instance, we have children spit into a tube And for less than $60 per person, we can measure hundreds of thousands or even millions of DNA differences between them. We're mostly focusing on differences between them in sort of single DNA letters, which are called SNPs. So what we're doing in these large-scale studies, which are called genome-wide association studies, is we're correlating those measured DNA differences between people and differences in social and behavioral outcomes. So this is something that is really familiar to people, I think, in the medical world, looking for genetics that are related, for instance, to obesity or hypertension or diabetes. What we're doing is we're relating these DNA differences to social and behavioral traits. So things like risk of ADHD or how far children go in school. What we can do with that information after we complete a genome-wide association study is take the correlations between all the DNA variants that we've estimated and then apply that information to a new sample of people and basically use it to add up information about their entire genome into a single number. And that number is called a polygenic index or a polygenic risk score. What's interesting about polygenic indices is that on the one hand, they're really messy. They're aggregating a ton of information across the whole genome. But at the same time, they are often as strongly correlated with the sort of outcomes that psychologists study as variables that we're kind of used to looking at in the social sciences. Yeah. So the classic example is that a polygenic index is as strongly correlated with your likelihood of graduating from college as family income is associated with your likelihood of graduating from college.
Well, let me just jump in. Can I just jump in here for just a quick second? Because, okay, so there's one word that you've used a couple times, which is like blaring in my head right now. Correlation.
Yes.
I mean, there is that basic scientific adage that correlation does not equal causation, right?
Yes.
So,
which is so important.
How do you address that?
So when we're looking at a basic genome-wide association study, which is measuring people who are not conventionally considered relatives, you are firmly in the realm of correlation. And so those correlations could reflect things that we think of as genetic causes. So something about my genes changed my biology, which changes my brain. But it could also reflect the fact that people who are genetically different are also environmentally different. And this is a huge scientific puzzle. Increasingly, what researchers are turning their attention to is the fact that we can unbraid a little bit genes from environments when we're looking within families. So I have two kids. When I, you know, I have inherited two copies of all of my genes, one from my mother, one from my father. And when each of my kids was conceived, they randomly got one version of each of my genes. And that randomness, that genetic lottery, which is the, you know, the titular metaphor of my book, is really important for researchers trying to figure out, is there actually genetic causes of these social and behavioral outcomes that we care about.
Okay. So let's take a step back here for just a second. I could spend the whole hour talking to you about the correlation causation dichotomy, where we are with that. But I do want to just get a basic understanding for people who are not familiar with this research at all. Just spend a minute talking to me about, like, what are one or two of the studies that you think point to the importance of thinking about genetics when it comes to social outcomes? And just, you sort of give me the 101 on this.
Yeah. So I think there's two studies that really pop out in my mind as being very compelling examples of why we need to have a conversation about this and our moral framework for genetic research. The first is one I've briefly referenced already. It was a 2018 study in Nature Genetics. They were studying 1.1 million people, and they found that a polygenic index from their genome-wide association study of educational attainment was as strongly related to the likelihood of graduating from college as family income. So if you're looking at students in the bottom 25% of the polygenic index, they were four times less likely to graduate from college than students in the highest 25% of the polygenic index. More recently, my colleagues and I, we just published a paper in Nature Neuroscience where we're looking at this not with education, but with problems related to addictive behavior and behavior problems. So ADHD, problematic alcohol use, illicit drug use. And we see similar patterns in that, for instance, a polygenic index can predict your likelihood of developing an opioid addiction problem, of ever being fired from work, of contact with the criminal justice system. Mm. These are life outcomes that we care about, right? That we have policy conversations about, that we want to close inequalities about. And we have this information that we're getting just from the genome that isn't predicting perfectly. This isn't a fortune teller, but it is capturing some of the differences. And so I think that's, you know, when we're thinking about, we can connect genetics to something like education or opiate addiction, we really have to think about how this information is going to be conceptualized and used moving forward.
Okay, so we're already getting some responses from listeners online here. Stephen Sasha, for example, sent us this message on Facebook. When genetics becomes a determinate factor, eugenics immediately follows. It is inevitable. It is instant. It destroys civilization. Now, I don't know how Stephen politically identifies here, but he is reflecting a deep and long concern amongst, if I can just put it broadly, progressives, political progressives in this country. But do you self-identify as politically progressive, Professor Hardin?
I do self-identify as politically progressive.
So is this book that you've written about trying to understand the importance of genes, is it really for them, for that group?
I think it's for everyone, because I think everyone can see in their own lives evidence that genes make a difference. There's a study that I love that asks just lay people, so people who are not specifically trained as scientists, to estimate, you know, how much does genetics make a difference for various life outcomes?
Yeah.
And everyone can really see it. So I'm writing the book so that people on both sides of the political spectrum can make sense of this research.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Catherine Page Hardin. She's a behavior geneticist and a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. She's out with a new book. It's called The Genetic Lottery: Why DNA Matters for Social Equality. And in the book, she argues that genetics aren't the only thing that determines social outcomes, but they are also part of the picture. And denying that fact is preventing us from closing social gaps in this country, from achieving the egalitarianism that the nation aspires towards. So we're going to talk about this new moral framework that you call for in terms of how to think about genes when it comes to social differences. We're going to talk about that a little later, Professor Hardin. But just before the break, you mentioned that your book isn't necessarily for the right or for the left exclusively. But in a sense, as a New Yorker said, you're waging a two-front campaign, right? Because there are some who believe that genetics are the only significant determinant of individual human outcomes. But there are others, and I would say that many of them are on the progressive left, who say that we cannot ascribe genes as a factor at all, that like we have to completely ignore genetic differences and instead just presume that everyone is the same. Now, why are you saying to that group that is wrong, that we make your argument about why we have to understand the importance of genes when it comes to social outcomes?
Yes. I mean, this is a really common concern. I think genetic difference is so entwined in people's minds with the threat of eugenics. So we have to really focus on what are the core ideas of eugenics so that we can respond to them. I think about there being three, I call them big, bad ideas that were inherent in eugenics. The first is that genetic difference makes some people better than other people, that there's superior persons and inferior persons. I think anyone who's been a parent can observe right off the bat why that idea is wrong. As a mother, I observe differences between my children that are probably genetically related. I write in the book about how one of my children has struggled with a speech and language impairment. And even as I observe the genetic differences between them, it doesn't make one of my children more valuable to me, more worth more to me. And in fact, observing that my kids are different is necessary to making sure that they each get what they need. So that's the first idea that I want to reject in this new anti-eugenic framework, that genetic difference is somehow inextricably bound up with differences in human worth. The second big bad idea from eugenics is this idea that genes are destiny, that if you have a certain genetic predisposition, there's nothing that can be done and that social policies or interventions are going to be useless for making people's lives better or bringing about more equal outcomes. And that's also obviously not true. Anyone in your audience who's wearing a pair of eyeglasses right now is experiencing an environmental intervention for something that likely has a partial genetic cause. In fact, and we can talk more specific examples, if we understand both how genes and environments are creating differences in people, it helps us design better interventions, better policies that I think fulfill psychology's purpose to help people thrive and succeed. And the last big bad idea in genetics is, and I think this is the one that's most concerning to people, is the idea that genetic difference justifies oppression, and specifically the violations of people's reproductive freedom. So in Virginia, where I went to grad school, for instance, they were the first state to pass a sterilization act in the 1920s, which mandated the involuntary sterilization of women who were judged to be inferior, right? And that obviously that burden fell primarily on women who were poor and women of color. I think it's interesting to contrast the Virginia Sterilization Act with a very different piece of 20th century legislation, which I think is really an anti-eugenic piece of legislation. And that's the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990. You know, the ADA doesn't pretend that people are all exactly the same in their functioning. The ADA mandates that we take into account difference so that people who experience the world differently have that sort of enjoy equal accommodation, right? I can't just say, well, I've treated everyone the same. Here is a staircase and be blind to the fact that people are different in their functioning.
I see. Okay.
So I think putting this together, when I say, you know, we need to have a new framework for understanding genetics, I don't think this science is going away. So we need to talk about making sense of it and using it in a way that values genetic diversity without this hierarchy, that uses genetic information to design better and more effective interventions and policies, and that comports with a vision of society in which we are interested in equalizing people's ability to participate regardless of the genes that they happen to inherit.
So you're absolutely right that the science is not going away. And in a minute or two, we're going to really dig into where the science is right now regarding genetics. But I have two quick questions to ask you, first of all, about your big thesis here. You know, I hear you when you say, like, genetics isn't determinative, but you earlier talked about the predictive value of some, like, the polygenic scores regarding educational attainment, and putting that in quotes, or even contact with the criminal justice system. So I mean, how predictive is the value here?
Yeah. So I think let me give you a concrete example, because I think it's easier to talk about when we're talking about a specific outcome. So I think people already recognize that there's genetic influences on your likelihood of developing an alcohol abuse problem, that you know, genes are relevant for your likelihood of becoming addicted to a substance. And part of that genetic influence is operating through how does your body metabolize alcohol or how does your brain respond to the rewarding effects of alcohol. But we also know from genetic research that part of the genetic influence is operating through personality traits that get you into certain types of environments. Do I like going to parties? Do I like hanging out with friends as a teenager who are going to be introducing me to substances? And it turns out that we can't, and I don't think we should, be manipulating, for instance, teenagers' genes, but we can put their families in family therapy where we teach their parents to monitor their curfew and their friend groups better. And when we do that, this is one of my favorite studies, we see that that polygenic risk score for that predicts your likelihood of developing an alcohol use problem stops being predictive of alcohol use amongst teenagers whose families have been in this family therapy
okay,
program.
Okay, but wouldn't you have to then do the genetic testing early for those interventions to work? I mean, I'm imagining a future where a baby, well, okay, this is, you've heard the Gattaca joke a bajillion times, so I'm not going to go there,
yes.
But like, you know, a baby gets a cheek swab, they have a polygenic risk score for probability of alcohol abuse, and so therefore, ideally, we would be able to provide them those services earlier, but it's also like a scarlet letter, is it not?
Yeah, so what I say in the book is that we really shouldn't be thinking of this genetic information as a diagnostic test about people, but really as a source of information about the interventions that we are providing for people. So even if we say that a polygenic score is predictive of your likelihood of alcoholism or that genes matter for addiction, there's a ton of uncertainty around those individual predictions. And I think the concerns about stigmatizing an individual child are valid. When we're thinking about, for instance, this family therapy program, we see that it's on average effective for most people. Making that more accessible, I think, would be a good thing. The genetic information is giving us a valuable piece of information about who's being served by that intervention. Is it actually reaching the people who are most at risk for these poor outcomes? I think, across a variety of educational interventions, family therapy interventions, policies, the genes aren't going to be useful as fortune tellers for an individual child. They're going to be useful for evaluating whether or not what we're doing is working for people who need the help the most.
Okay. So I want to just sort of take a different track for a moment, because I still think that most people, and I'll include myself here, do not actually fully understand how advanced the science is in terms of the steps we're taking towards understanding genetics and also what we can do to them, to genetics, in human bodies. So you talked about like this, the science isn't going to stop. And I want to talk about where it is right now. So, for example, we've got some real world examples here. We spoke with Saik Katharison, and he's chief executive officer and co-founder of a company called Verve Therapeutics.
We are trying to solve heart attack, the world's leading cause of death. And human genetics research that we and others did over the last decade or so has suggested a solution.
So he's talking there about cardiac applications of genetic advances. In short, Verve Therapeutics is looking at the DNA of people who are at low risk, especially low risk of having a heart attack. Some of them have low LDL cholesterol levels in their blood. And then here's what Verve plans to do. The company will go to patients who are at high risk of heart attack and edit their genes to mimic those who are at low risk.
It's literally like an eraser. The A is erased and a G is placed there. The consequence of that is the PCSK9 cholesterol-raising gene is turned off and cholesterol comes down.
And Verve Therapeutics so far has seen this approach work in monkeys, and they expect to start human studies next year. So one, like, medical example of how our understanding of polygenic risk is being applied to human hearts. So let's get yet another example here. Professor Hardin, stand by, because I want to bring in Carrie Goldberg. She's the Boston Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Carrie, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
Polygenic risk scoring is being used in IVF and embryo selection. That's your new story. Picking embryos with best health odds sparks new DNA debate. What's going on?
Right. So when I learned that this was actually happening, it just kind of blew off the top of my head that, in fact, polygeny risk scoring was already being used in this way. There was a big special report in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Problems with Using Polygenic Scores to Select Embryos. And my reaction was like, wait, they're already doing this? They're using polygenic scores to select embryos? It was a great contrast with, you know, reporting that many of us did when CRISPR was exploding and we started saying, oh, there's about to be designer babies, but we knew it would be many years before any parent in their right mind would use CRISPR on an embryo because there could be off-target effects and then you would have yourself to blame for, you know, messing up your child. In this case, what's happening is that parents who are already doing IVF and are offered various kinds of testing of the embryos before they're implanted are now, if they choose, there are several companies that they can use to do polygenic testing on those embryos in order to choose which one or ones to implant. And so they can get a kind of a health score on their embryos about which, let's say, embryo one could be much likelier to have a common disease like cancer or diabetes or heart disease later on in life, and embryo five. Oh, and also, by the way, schizophrenia and other diseases, common diseases. And embryo five may have a much, much lower chance of having the diseases of interest. And so you would choose to implant embryo one rather than embryo five.
How precise are the predictions that they give to people, Carrie?
Well, that is under some dispute, you know, and part of what the New England Journal piece was saying was, look, some of these differences are probably very, very small. Parents need to understand that it's only probabilities. It's not guarantees of what will happen. But as you were hearing from Professor Hardin, you know, the science on these polygenic risk scores has been advancing incredibly quickly, and they can, in fact, pick up substantial differences.
Okay, so, but it actually might make sense to a lot of people that, you know, to get a better understanding of if their potential future child has a high risk for a certain genetically inherited disease, or much more likely to have a cardiovascular disease, or even some severe mental illnesses. But is that all that these polygenic risk scores can test for?
So I believe you're alluding to the possibility that they could be used to look for probabilities of intelligence or of height or of weight. And so that's one of the aspects of this that is most fraught. Now, we do not know of any companies that are offering this now, but it would certainly be possible based on studies like the kind that Professor Hardin does on things like educational attainment. And so it raises this really interesting question of a sort of different type of eugenics. You know, the kind that Professor Hardin talks about was absolutely horrifying. But now some people are talking about what could be called liberal eugenics, or, you know, reproductive choice, in which parents would be seeking better starts for their kids, and they would use this technology to choose children with the best odds of health or of some other desired outcome.
But you're saying that regards to health outcome, those options are already available for those who can afford IVF and get the scores for these potential embryos.
Right. So they're just starting to be available. There's a handful of companies that are offering this. What's been done for many years is what's called pre-implantation genetic testing for single gene diseases like Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis, where parents would choose the embryo that would not have that disease. This is now applying the polygenic risk scores, which look at very, very common diseases that many people might be interested in avoiding for their kids.
And so your point being that one of the potential downsides to this is, you know, again, radically different health outcomes down the future, down the line, because parents were able to choose based on a polygenic risk score at the embryonic stage. But what is the, we've just got about a minute left to go here before we have to take a break, Carrie. What's the outlook for embryonic risk scores, if I can call it that?
Yes. Well, I mean, the demand is predicted to rise because, you know, genetic testing is advancing so quickly. It's getting much cheaper. It's getting much better. Of course, the question would be how many people would do IVF on purpose in order to be able to do this if they didn't really need it. IVF is no picnic, and that remains to be seen.
Well, Carrie Goldberg is Boston Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Her new story is called Picking Embryos with Best Health Odds Sparks New DNA Debate. And we have a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Carrie, thank you so much for giving us a window into where the science stands right now regarding polygenic risk scores.
You're welcome.
Professor Catherine Page Harden, if you hang on here for just a second, we'll pick up with that thought and some of the really impassioned criticism of even considering genes when it comes to figuring out solutions for to differential social outcomes. There's a lot of feedback we're getting on that. So hang on here for just a moment. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are having a fascinating conversation with Professor Catherine Page Harden. She is a behavior geneticist and professor of psychology at the University of Texas, out with a new book. It's called The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality. And again, in this book, she argues that we have to understand the influence and importance of genetic differences in people if we are truly going to achieve an egalitarian society, if we're going to close social gaps between people here. And Professor Harden, I promised that we would introduce some of the impassioned pushback that I know you've received throughout your career here in advocating for especially the left to think more about genetics. So just listen along with me for a moment, because in 2018, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that was titled Why Progressives Should Embrace the Genetics of Education. And in that op-ed, you wrote, quote, "In Americans with European ancestry, just over 10% of people with a low polygenic score completed college, compared with 55% of people with a high polygenic score. This genetic disparity in college completion is as big as the disparity between rich and poor students in America." Well, that produced a really powerful response. Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, said at the time, "There's just no way that genetic testing is going to lead to restructuring of society in a just way in the future." So 3 years later, we checked in with her, and Professor Roberts has only deepened her criticism of this approach.
"I have no confidence at all that doing research on genetic contributions to educational or other kinds of social inequities is going to advance a progressive agenda of a more equal, humane, and just society. We have a whole long history of showing that that kind of research has always done the opposite. It has always reinforced social inequities."
And, you know, Professor Hardin, earlier in the show, you pointed to sort of the three big negative aspects of previous applications of genetic research to social outcomes. And in fact, Professor Roberts, too, pointed to those examples.
During the eugenics era in the early 20th century, the theory that intelligence was inherited justified policies that encouraged coercive sterilization laws against groups that were predicted to have low intelligence. We can skip forward to the 1970s when Berkeley psychologist Arthur Jensen argued that Black students had innate cognitive inferior traits, and that that meant that there was no point in directing federal programs to try to improve their educational attainment. That's from the 1970s. You know, it's not ancient history. More recently, the Bell Curve, which was published in the 1990s, argued that, again, it was wasteful to direct resources to students who were predicted to be less intelligent.
So, Professor Hardin, I know that in the past you've written that, quote, this is a mistake. Those of us who value social justice should instead be asking, how can the power of the genomic revolution be harnessed to create a more equal society? You know, we put that to Professor Dorothy Roberts, and she basically told us that she believes the most important point is this, that in her mind, in every single case throughout history, the idea that difference in educational attainment seemed to be, as she put it, quote unquote, innate, it always supported policies that harmed the people who were predicted to be less educationally capable. And she told us, she says, there's no reason to believe that pattern will change.
I really bristle at the argument that, well, Professor Roberts, you're just talking about racist, white supremacist eugenicists. And as long as we don't put the research in their hands, our policy recommendations could bear fruit. Now I'm absolutely confident in saying that this research will not and cannot accomplish progressive ends. And so if the question is, where should we be devoting our resources to achieve a more equal society, it should not be in exploring the genetic contributions to social inequities. It should be to ending them.
That's Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. So, Catherine Page Hardin, let's get right down to it. How do we craft, as you put it, this moral framework that includes a understanding of genetics that can overcome the very reasoned concerns of people such as Professor Roberts?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And I just want to say that I agree with Professor Roberts about the history. Where we disagree is what we do from here, given where the science is and is moving. So she's absolutely right that there has been a deliberate crafting of this idea that if something is genetically associated, it's innate. And so therefore, we should not invest in social programs that improve people's lives. She's absolutely right about that history. So what do we do now? I think often the approach is then, well, let's not measure genes. Let's not collect genetic information. Let's keep, let's try to put that genie back in the bottle. Unfortunately, that leaves all of the science and all of the meaning making about the science to people who don't care about that history. So as instructive and in many ways horrifying as our history is, the solution to that, which is to say, let's never observe anything about the way that people genetically differ, even though most people in the lay public already know that that's true, like already think that genes make a difference, is just not a viable path forward. So when I wrote this book, it really was beginning from that perspective, which is if there is no way to undo the knowledge that genes make a difference for people's lives? How do we move forward? Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that means that we need to have people who are committed to the goals of social equality, doing this work, reflecting on this work, thinking about it. And we need to have more examples like the family therapy program that I told you about earlier, in which we can point to and say, by understanding genes, I've figured out how to better intervene. And it's, I think, ultimately only through the accumulation of real world examples like that, that we can start to undo this incredibly pernicious association of genetic equals innate.
So it seems as if you are advocating for something that I've seen called the hereditarian left.
Yeah, that's a very controversial phrase.
What is that?
So hereditarian is a really difficult word. You know, some people use the word hereditarian to just simply mean the study of heredity matters for understanding people's lives, in which case, I have no problem with it. You also find uses of the word hereditarian, which imply that heredity is the only thing that matters for people's lives, that those hereditary differences break down across racial lines, which I think is a mistake, and that those genetic differences are inexorable and immutable to social change. And I don't agree with that at all. So that's the kind of hereditarian. But if you just take the simpler meaning of hereditarian means you think heredity matters for how people end up differently, then we can take that as a starting point. And then the left is, what are the left's, you know, speaking in broad brushstrokes, typical political and social concerns, which is really, you know, in my case, around egalitarianism. How can we equalize people's opportunities, people's ability to participate, people's rights and welfare and resources? And so those two things, the study of heredity and egalitarian politics, have historically been considered opposing. And I'm trying very ambitiously, I think, to try to get people to rethink the ways in which the study of heredity can be used for egalitarian goals.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit more, because I think you've, to a previous reporter in the New Yorker, give them credit, fantastic article. but they said that you had pointed them, for example, to a World Bank data set released, a year ago, that showed when you look very broadly at inequalities, it's not necessarily between demographic, I don't want to say this wrong, but between demographic groups, but within them. Tell me more
about
it.
It's both.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think if we, one insight of being a psychologist, I think, is just how variable human lives are. And we can see certain forms of inequalities of outcome according to visible markers of inequality. So these are differences according to race or according to social class. But if we look at just how people differ in this one aspect of inequality, which is their educational lives, we see that only about a quarter of those differences is accounted for by things we can see, these racial divisions, these class divisions, these between classroom or between school divisions. There's a huge pool of variation that is invisible if we're only looking at these racial or class differences. And that isn't to say that those aren't important. Those are obviously important. But education has become such a fault line for inequality in our country in terms of how long people live, how healthy they are, how happy they are, that I don't think we can ignore these other sources of inequality, which might be harder to see without the genetic tools that we now have access to. Mm.
You also, Professor Hardin, you also make the point that perhaps why a large-scale societal adoption of some of these, these interventions or the channeling of resources to people might be more socially accepted if we understand better that the differences are due to things that people cannot quote unquote choose to overcome, right?
Yeah. So this is really about the psychology of luck and how people's intuitions about whether or not resources should be shared change when the role of luck is made more salient for them. So if we just are looking at surveys, people are more likely to support greater economic equality if inequalities that do exist are portrayed as being due to lucky factors outside of people's control versus things that they earned or deserved. And we also see this in laboratory research and economic games, where if you highlight the role of chance, people are more likely to be willing to share. So I think right now we have such a huge political division in even whether or not we think inequality is a problem to be addressed. And I think that for some people, highlighting the role of luck, not just environmental luck, but genetic luck in those inequalities of outcome might cause some people to stop and reflect on the extent to which our national prosperity should be shared.
Mm. So we've just got about 3 minutes left, and I've got two more. Actually, I have 100 more questions for you, Professor, but I'll limit myself to maybe two. And the first is, so just briefly, help me understand sort of when we talk about this moral framework, just mm-hmm. give me a couple sentences on exactly what you mean. What is that moral framework? And then how does it translate itself? It means nothing unless it's translated itself into the policies that you're talking about that could then erase the differences in social outcomes. So how does that happen?
Yeah, so I describe this in detail in the last chapter of my book, this anti-eugenic framework. Maybe the best way to think about it is to, again, come back to this question of what world would you want to live in? What society would you want to live in if you had no idea what the outcome of the genetic lottery was going to be for you or your kids? And I think if we take that perspective into thinking about how we design education policy, how we design healthcare policy. As a mother, if I'm looking at what makes a good school, I'm not looking for a school that's going to treat all of my kids the same. I'm looking for a school that's going to equalize their ability to profit from that school, to learn, to accommodate their uniqueness. Ultimately, I think that lies very close to the heart of what makes a social structure or a policy good. So I want people, when they think about genetic difference, to think about if genes really do matter, and I think they do, what kind of world do we want to live in, given that every time we conceive a child, we have so little control over what's going to happen there? How do we accommodate that role of chance and luck for everyone to participate as equals?
Genetic chance and luck, you're saying specifically mm-hmm. here. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so then finally, though, I'm still feeling the weight of history here.
Yes, of course.
Right? And you're, I mean, some of your colleagues have called your call for this new moral framework around genetics to be both ambitious. Well, someone even called it quixotic. Because mm-hmm. We just got 30 seconds left here. How can you prevent those who want to be genetic absolutists from co-opting what you're saying? Some folks are already calling you a Charles Murray in a skirt.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's no way that we can prevent bad actors. But in order to say what we want to do, we need to have an articulation of what is the goal? What are we moving towards? And even if that goal is, it is idealistic, it gives us a framework to evaluate, is this policy closer to an anti-eugenic framework, or is this policy something that's going to entrench the inequalities of birth that are already so pernicious in our society? I think we need to know where we're going in order to know whether we're making progress getting there.
Without a doubt. And as we heard earlier in the hour, the science, whether people like it or not, is charging forward apace. So we have to come up with some kind of moral framework around that. So
we definitely do.
Catherine Page Harden, the new book is The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality. We've got an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Professor Harden, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and is distributed by APM, American Public Media.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. From Aspiration, working to help people combat climate change with a credit card that lets them plant a tree with every purchase. One card, zero carbon footprint. Aspiration.com/credit. Aspiration Financial LLC. And Indeed, an integrated hiring platform for businesses of any size to schedule virtual interviews and connect to candidates directly on the employer dashboard. More at Indeed.com/NPR.
In the U.S., individual rights are sacrosanct.
We tend to approach rights disputes as questions of who the Constitution prefers.
Legal scholar Jamal Green calls that rightism, and he says it's pushing the country in the wrong direction.
Those kinds of stakes cause people to dig in and move into their corners.
So he says it's time to reduce the focus on individual rights. That's on the next On Point.